just gets bigger, the metric just gets multiplied by an overall factor, which means that if you wait long enough for any fixed point, let's say you're sitting at the origin, then eventually all around you, you'll see flat space. This is, solutions like this are called Ricci solitons by mathematicians. And as far as I know, this particular one was not previously known to them. And it's some complicated, I mean, the geometry is perfectly simple. The formula for the geometry, for the metric is complicated. I won't bother you with it. But anyway, this is actually a quantitative plot of what the cone looks like. So you just take this shape and you rotate it around the z-axis and you get a nice rounded out cone. Okay. A second line of reasoning for trying to understand what happens. So basically that solution that I showed you tells you what happens at late times, but you might complain that it might never get to that point. It might never get to the point where the curvature radius is large in the first place, because something horrible might happen at the very beginning when the energy is still infinitely concentrated. And so to tackle that problem, of course, supergravity methods are not going to work. You have to do some real string theory, and a good thing to do is to use a D-brain probe, which sees very small distances because it's point-like and very massive. So what you do is you put a D-brain localized in this geometry, and in the other eight direct or the other seven spatial directions, it can be localized or not. It doesn't really matter. And then you write down the theory. The low-energy theory living on this brain, and not surprisingly, it has a moduli space, which is, of course, C mod Zn. Okay, so as far as it's concerned, the space-time is C mod Zn, so that's good. By the way, this theory living on the brain is non-supersymmetric for the same reason that the bulk closed-string theory is non-supersymmetric. But it's still amenable to study, and then what you can do is you can ask what happens when I turn on this tachyon vertex operator. So when the closed string tachyons condense, then they will, you'll have a background of closed string tachyons which will couple to the open strings living on the D-brain and will change the theory living on the D-brain. And in particular, will change its low energy dynamics and therefore will change the moduli space. And you can see what is, you know, you can actually see what are the corrections to the Lagrangian of the D-brain probe theory when you turn on this tachyon vertex operator. And then you can calculate the moduli space as a function of the size of the tachyon, the VEV of the tachyon. And what you find is that this moduli space, which, as I said, is a cone on C mod Zn, gets rounded out. Now, these pictures are on substringy scale, unlike the ones on the previous transparency, which were on larger than stringy scale. And at stringy scale, we really just don't know. We just don't have the tools. Except that I should mention one other piece of work, which is not, strictly speaking, on this system, because it's on the C mod Zn orbital fold in the bosonic theory, which was done recently by Okawa and Zwiebach, in which they used Zwiebach's closed string field theory to, in a level truncation analysis, to find the potential for this tachyon. And they found, it's quite delicate because, of course, there you do have a bulk tachyon. So you sort of have to fine tune the bulk tachyon to keep it from condensing while you start to condense this localized tachyon. But okay, they found that you can do it, at least in this approximation, and so that suggests that this minimum does exist. The idea that this minimum corresponds to flat space, as it should, there's no direct evidence for, but it's very suggestive. And the energy difference that you get is sort of seems to be converging to the right one, as in all of this level truncation analysis that people did of open string field theory in the decay of D-brains. Okay, so that, I didn't I don't know if there was a single equation on those last few transparencies. So that's just a quick review of sort of what was known. Now, let's actually solve some equations. The equations we want to solve are addressing the following question. What happens to the energy, basically? So you have this energy which is highly concentrated at the origin. And if we imagine that indeed the orbifold decays in a way that is not too violent, that is that basically what happens is that the energy does somehow get out without actually tearing the space-time, then at late times, the energy should be spread out enough and the curvature should therefore be small enough that you can actually apply supergravity and find a time-dependent solution which describes this, the actual decay. So rather than using these indirect arguments, actually see what happens when this thing decays. So this is a problem that in the open string case, people were able to sort of sweep under the rug for a long time because the amount of energy in a D-brain, its coupling to gravity, goes to zero as you take the string coupling to zero. But as we saw at the beginning, the mass of this orbifold goes like 1 over kappa squared. So it doesn't matter how small you make kappa, the gravitational back reaction is always going to be just as strong. So you have to deal with the gravitational back reaction in the decay. You can't understand the decay separately from the gravitational back reaction. But it turns out that in this case, the equations are simple enough that you can just go ahead and solve them, which was what was done in these two papers. So the reason it's so simple is that, first of all, you have very few fields. Of course, you have very few dimensions, only 2 plus 1, and you have this rotational symmetry. And the only fields that are active are the metric and the dilaton. Because you're in three dimensions, the B field doesn't actually have any dynamics. And the metric also sort of doesn't have any independent dynamics. There's no propagating graviton in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Okay, and what I'm going to show you is that, normally the problem in solving equations of this type, if you want to solve, you know, the equation of the motion for matter collapsing into a black hole or something like that, or two black holes colliding or something, is that the gravitational back reaction of whatever matter is running around complicates your life. Okay, so what I'm going to show is that in this system, just by luck, of course, it's not really by luck, but the gravitational back reaction on the dilaton, which is what's actually carrying the energy away. So the picture we're going to have is that there's going to be a wave of dilaton carrying this energy away to infinity. And you can solve that equation without even knowing what the gravitational back reaction is. So how does that work? Just a few equations. So here's our Einstein equation. Now, we're free to work in light cone coordinates, u and v. So without loss of generality, we can put the metric in this form. And now you start looking at this equation. If phi has no angular dependence, because we're assuming an S-wave decay, then r theta theta must be 0. That implies, when you solve for r theta theta for this metric, that this function r, which is the proper radius of the theta circle, obeys this equation in terms of its dependence on u and v, so that it separates into a function of u and a function of v. And then you define you make a coordinate transformation. So this metric here, I haven't completely used up all of my coordinate, my diffeomorphism freedom, because I can change u to be any function of u and v to be any function of v and still leave the metric in this form. So we're going to do that. We're going to change u to be r sub u and v to be r minus r sub v. And then by definition, r is u minus v. Call u plus vt. And then here's our metric. Okay. Now, maybe I can leave that there. Now, we've already used one Einstein equation, but let's go to the phi equation of motion for a second. Here's the phi equation of motion. By the way, I should have said I'm working in Einstein frame here. So this is the great thing about this equation, when this is the metric, is that sigma, which encodes basically the gravitational backrush, so the only non-trivial information about what the metric is in this sigma function. And sigma simply doesn't enter into the phi equation of motion. So the program is to solve the phi equation of motion, and then you can go back and find the gravitational backreaction by using the rest of the Einstein equations, which we haven't used yet, which are here. So basically, phi acts as a source for the sigma field. Again, sigma encoding the curvature you have. Okay, so what do you learn from this? Well, one thing you learn, which is not terribly surprising, is that, you know, because gravity is not that powerful in 2 plus 1 dimensions, you don't have any problems with singularities forming or anything like that during the gravity phase of the decay. Now, of course, okay, so let me just show you some solutions to this so you can get a sense for what they actually look like. Which is, of course, the most fun part, is actually seeing the solutions. Now, I mean, I should say, I'm not writing down a particular solution, because until you know exactly what happens during the initial phase, until you know what your initial conditions are, which we don't, because we don't know exactly what happens during the stringy phase of the decay, of course, you don't know, you don't know exactly what happens at late times, but assuming that the energy is released quickly in some string scale time, then you can sort of model it arbitrarily. And what you do is you put a source on the right-hand side of the dilaton equation of motion. Which represents the release of energy during the stringy phase of the decay. And if, and this is just basically an example pulled out of a hat, but we can make the source just a Gaussian, for example, in space and time, and then you solve for phi, which is easy enough, and then you solve for sigma. And initially, of course, so what I've plotted here, so there are four time slices, and what I've plotted is the geometry at each time, which starts out just as a cone, so this is for the case of C mod Z3, then, so there's nothing here. And then above the cone here, I've plotted the dilaton wave as it goes out as a function of r. And it's between this picture and this picture, it's been sourced. And what happens is that it smooths out this conical singularity, and then when it carries the energy away with it, what's left inside this is a flat disk, because if there's no energy, then there's no curvature. And so what you end up with is a growing disk. And here's the dilaton wave moving outward at the speed of light. So that's a pretty satisfying picture, I think. And that's basically as much, I think, as we could hope to know about the gravitational phase of the decay. Yeah, so there's a fairly serious question, which I think is unresolved, about how long the decay actually takes. And what I said before was that we can imagine that the decay occurs on a string scale, time scale, meaning that you sort of go, meaning that the energy is released from this very small area in a short time. This is not necessarily the case. I mean, it might happen instead that the energy is dumped into massive string modes, which then sit around for a long time and decay over a very long time. So the answer basically is that I don't know. But if they do, then this, you would just take this same, these same equations and put in a source which was sort of very slowly letting the energy leak out, and it would, you know, then you'd see what happened then. Yeah.
So kind of related problem. So you just get one ripple, that's your picture, or you could get multiple ripples corresponding to the cone decreasing, that is tangled. So which one?
Yeah. So I mean, these equations will describe whatever happens. So if we imagine that the decay had been fine-tuned so that the cone goes to a larger cone, so n goes to some smaller value of n, then that's fine. And then at the end, you won't actually have a disk, but you'll just have that smaller cone. I'd be surprised if with fine-tuning, you can probably get to, you know, from n to some smaller n prime. I'd be surprised if the decay sort of happened by this multiple release of energy, but if it did, then, you know, these equations could certainly accommodate that. Any other questions? Okay, so now we're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about things that we don't know so well. Basically, we want to find any way we can to get some control over this problem. And one idea for getting control, and this is an idea due to Atish Dabholkar, is to look at its large N limit. So let me explain where that idea comes from. You might think that things just get messier and messier as N gets larger. And generically they do, but there's a sector where they don't. So what does the large N limit look like? Well, if you looked at that formula I had for the mass spectrum, of course you have N minus one twisted sectors, each one contains at least one tachyon, and their masses are evenly distributed between 0 and minus 2 over alpha prime. With the result that the larger N is, the lighter tachyons you have. Okay, so the very lightest tachyon you have is going to be in the second twisted sector. So basically the way it works is that the odd twisted sectors are way down here. So it kind of, like, the first twisted sector is the most tachyonic one, then the second twisted sector is the least tachyonic one, then the third twisted sector is the second most tachyonic one, and so on. So it goes back and forth. So you can make this tachyon parametrically light by taking n to infinity. Now, why are we particularly interested in this one? Well, if you look at Vafa's picture for the world sheet RG flow, you find that this particular tachyon actually leads not to flat space, but to C mod Z n minus 2, which is the closest lighter orbifold. It can't be C mod Z n minus 1 because n has to be odd. Basically, if you turn on the vertex operator for this tachyon on the world sheet and see what happens when you flow to the IR, what you flow to is the C mod Z n minus 2 orbifold. Okay, so that's one interesting observation. Another interesting observation is that this orbifold is lighter than C mod Zn by an amount which is parametrically small in n. Okay, so this is the energy difference between C mod Zn, here's n C mod Zn minus 2, here's C mod Zn minus 2, C mod Zn, the difference goes like 1 over n squared. So that's rather suggestive. You have a very light tachyon, and it leads to a point where the energy difference is very small. So here's Atiche's conjecture. Which is that the potential for this tachyon looks like this. So, of course, it has a 1 over kappa squared prefactor because it's a closed string, because the tachyon is a closed string field. So we'll plot kappa squared times the potential. So at its critical points, this should describe the ADM mass of the orbifold, this kappa squared times V of t. So the conjecture is that this potential has a quartic term which turns it up at a distance that's down by a power of n from the origin, and that this critical point is C mod Zn minus 2. And if this is true, and if this critical point is indeed C mod Zn minus 2, so that we know what that energy is, that energy difference is, then this coefficient should be 1 over 4 pi. In other words, it shouldn't be down by any powers of n. Okay.
Why is the potential function of only one mode?
Okay, so there are, of course, all of these other tachyons in the system. Now, you can show that the couplings to the the couplings to the very tachyonic tachyons are actually suppressed. Okay, so they have this picture wouldn't make any sense if when you're here you're sourcing some very tachyonic tachyon. Okay. If you're sourcing something which is almost as light as this one, then it would just mean that this picture has some corrections, and it's not correct to actually just truncate the dynamics to its, or I should say, it's an approximation to truncate the dynamics to just this one mode. Okay, and that, so there's that question, and then there's the question of the higher order terms in T, which I've also neglected, and if their coefficients are of order 1 or smaller, then because of where this minimum is, because this minimum is at a distance that's 1 over root n from the origin, then those would also be negligible. Okay. Right, so this is, those couplings would also be there and is how the energy gets out, but that's okay. I don't think there's a problem with this. No, I mean, one thing we don't know is exactly what happens in terms of what other fields are sourced when this tachyon condenses. It's not, as Leonardo pointed out, it's not necessarily going to be as simple as just the dilaton being directly sourced by this tachyon, right? All kinds of massive string modes could be excited, and then those would decay, and so on. So it could be a very complicated multi-stage process. Yeah?
What about mutants? They also have mutations of
that subgroup. Yeah, I suppose so.
I mean, as long as the charge is zero, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, and I suppose there's enough energy present to do that.
The least tachyon is the guy that's winding sort of once around the circle.
Twice, yeah.
Twice.
This one, you mean?
Yeah. So you're saying that that nonlinear terms in this potential can't source something that winds four times around?
Yeah, they can, but, well, let's see. Oh, right, okay, sorry. So you're worried about, okay, sorry, you're worried about terms that are like, if I call the excited, the next one that winds around four times t prime, terms like t squared t prime. Okay, those terms are absent or are suppressed by powers of 1 over n. And that's a fact about the conformal field theory correlators in the orbifold theory. Okay, so if those terms were there or were not suppressed by powers of 1 over n, then you would worry that as soon as you turn this guy on, then t prime would be sourced and would start rolling. Those terms are not there. And then the ones that wind an odd number of times, which are the ones that are very tachyonic, can't be sourced because of the conservation of winding number. Yeah.
Okay.
It has to do with picture changing operators on the world sheet and
okay.
Yeah. Okay, so if this picture is correct, then we have a prediction for this quartic coupling. The quartic coupling is something that you can calculate directly in the orbifold conformal field theory, which has been done by Dabhokar, Iqbal, and Reimekers. Yeah.
If you smooth it out this orbifold by adding a shift, would the statement still be true?
I have no idea. Right.
It's the statement something that carrying momentum one has no, doesn't induce things carrying momentum two in supergravity. That sounds surprising to me.
Yeah. Actually, let me say something about that in a few minutes.
Okay.
Well, I won't have very much to say, so don't get too excited, but it's just better if I wait. Okay. So basically, you can calculate that quartic term in the orbifold conformal field theory by working very hard. And they did. But I'm lazy. So here's a shortcut. And it's kind of a cool shortcut because it, like I said, it turns the tables and actually makes use of gravity to make our life easier instead of harder. And the picture is the following. Basically, you want to ask, what does this cone look like at large n? And this is what it looks like. It's a very sharp cone. And what you have is a circle fibered over half line. You can think of it that way. Now, it's a thermal circle because as you go around, for the same reason that as you go around, as you rotate a plane by 2 pi, you get a minus 1 for the fermions. This is a thermal thermal circle. So it has antiperiodic boundary conditions on the fermions. The size of this circle varies very slowly as a function of distance to the origin. And so up to a distance n string lengths, it's actually smaller than a string length in radius. So there are basically three key distance scales that I want you to keep in mind for this problem. One of them is the string length distance to the origin. The other is root n string lengths, and I'll explain why that's interesting. And then the third is n string lengths. OK, we have a very small circle. So for this whole range here, we have a very small circle. So of course, we should t-dualize it. And of course, you have to keep in mind that it's a thermal circle. There is antiperiodic boundary conditions on the fermions, so that makes it a little bit more complicated. I'll say how, for those of you who haven't studied that. But I mean, it's no problem t-dualizing thermal circles. So this is the geometry you get. Now, of course, this is not an exact picture. To get from here to here, I've done what's called naive t-duality or Buescher duality, where I just do a geometrical duality on this, this circle. And that's not exactly correct because, for example, you can see that winding number, you know, this is not a cylinder. Winding number is not strictly speaking conserved. It's only conserved mod n, even if n is large, because strings can sort of add to their, can change their winding number by n by slipping through the fixed point. So winding number is not conserved here, so momentum shouldn't be conserved here. But there is an exact version of this, which is just mirror symmetry. But as long as you stay away from this fixed point, this is, so as long as you stay more than a few string lengths from this fixed point, this is a good approximate description of the physics. So it's not good if you wanted to study what's happening to the tachyon. So you might think at first that this is useless for studying tachyon condensation because, of course, we know that the tachyons are localized near the fixed point. But wait and you'll see. So what we get here is, well, because this is a thermal circle, this is actually in, now in type, sort of roughly speaking, in type zero theory. At least the bulk fields are type zero fields. But with the funny fact that the fields that don't come from type two, for example, the type zero tachyon, have antiperiodic boundary conditions on this circle. So that's just a fact about what happens when you t-dualize a thermal circle. In type 2 theory, you end up with basically type 0, with a circle with, that's type 0, but with antiperiodic boundary conditions on the type 0 fields. OK. Now, this thing, of course, if you just ignore what's happening here, where it's a mess, it is a solution to the gravitational equations of motion, but it's actually an unstable one, putting aside the type zero instability, of course. So what is the relation between the tachyons in that we know and love on Cmod Zn and what's going on here? OK, well, that's actually simple to work out, at least for some of them. Basically, it's simple to work out for the tachyons that are very light and the tachyons that are very heavy. And the reason is that those are the ones with a small winding number. So if you look at this picture, tachyons that have a small winding number, well, all of the tachyons are wound around the circle, and so they're all attracted to the fixed point because of their tension. But how attracted they are depends on how many times they wind around. So the ones that wind around only a small number of times are not really stuck that close to the origin. They're free to wander off. You can make that precise and actually write down a wave function and see that the width of the wave function, I mean, they're basically sitting in a harmonic oscillator potential. And so you get a nice Gaussian wave function whose width is actually given by this root n alpha prime, which is why I'm interested in this particular length scale. Okay, so those guys sit in a shallow harmonic oscillator potential with the wave function extending out to this distance scale root n alpha prime. Okay, so for example, the very tachyonic tachyons, where they come from is the modes of this type 0 bulk tachyon here. And the origin of the harmonic oscillator potential in this picture is this is the antiperiodicity of their boundary conditions, okay, which keeps them confined to the region where the circle is large, okay, which is why we don't care too much about the fact. You might worry, oh no, we have type zero theory, and that means you now have a bulk tachyon, and how can this be when we knew that here we didn't have a bulk tachyon? And the reason is that there's really no bulk tachyon if you move far enough away to where the circle is sufficiently small, that the momentum around the circle cancels the negative mass squared of the type zero tachyon. But the lowest mode sits here, and if you remember that mass formula, which I'm sure you don't by now, but trust me, this is the mass of the most tachyonic tachyon. It's not quite minus 2 over alpha prime, which is the mass of the type zero tachyon, but it has this small correction. And that's just the zero point energy from this harmonic oscillator. Yeah. Okay. Now, what about the light ones? Well, those are actually due to this instability, this gravitational instability I was mentioning before. And you can, by looking at this metric and looking at gravitational perturbations about it, you can find that it has an unstable mode, which is given by this. This is the fluctuation in the metric. And you can actually match the mass. So the point is that if we're interested in studying these light tachyons, then it becomes a gravity problem, which is nice because that's easier than a stringy problem. Maybe I should leave this. Okay, also these couplings that you're worried about, Shiraz, you can also calculate them from this gravity picture, and I haven't completed the calculation, but I think that it does actually come out to zero, even in the gravity picture. I think that there's a, basically these different winding numbers turn into different helicities, and there's a selection rule for the helicities, which rules out interactions of that form. So that it should be true in that picture you were discussing. Okay, so now let me emphasize again something important, which is that because we're taking n to be parametrically large, you know, this region inside of the string length is dangerous, and this picture is not valid there, but these modes are spread out, and they care mainly about what's going on in this region. And since n we're taking to be large, the sort of dangerous region is a very, very small part of their wave function, like 1 over n. Okay, so now to the point. Whoops. We can use this picture to estimate that quartic coupling. And basically the point here, sorry, I keep switching back. I should just leave this one on forever. The point is that in the gravity solution, except for this little root n, which doesn't matter, it's just an overall multiplicative factor, n doesn't appear in the gravity solution. Only this L does, which is root n alpha prime. So anything you calculate in gravity can only be a function of L. It's the unique length scale that defines this metric. Another way of saying that is that if you want to look at the limit n goes to infinity with n alpha prime held fixed, which is the limit we're interested in because the mass of the tachyon we're interested in is basically minus 1 over n alpha prime. So we're holding n alpha prime fixed while taking n to infinity and alpha prime to 0. In that limit, this geometry is perfectly well behaved. So it only knows about this length scale n alpha prime. It doesn't know anything about alpha prime. At least gravity on it doesn't know anything about alpha prime. And I just told you that the tachyon we're interested in is a gravitational mode. So whatever coupling you calculate is just going to be a function of n alpha prime. And that means that you can use dimensional analysis, which tells you the power of alpha prime, to conclude what the power of n is. And that's what we're interested in. We're interested in whether this coupling is of order 1 or of order 1 over n or something else. So you can do that. And what you find is that just on dimensional grounds, this T field is a dimensionless, I normalized it so it was a dimensionless field. And so what you'll find, because you have this 1 over n out in front, is that the whole kappa squared V of T, which of course, as we already knew, starts out with basically 1 over n times T squared, the next term has to also be 1 over n t to the fourth. So there's no order 1 piece. And sadly, that basically kills this idea. Once there's a 1 over n here, it means that in that potential, the quartic term is too weak to actually turn it over at a small distance, to turn it over at a distance where, for example, you can neglect all of the higher order terms, you can neglect the couplings to other tachyons and so on. Okay, so at that point, it's some very complicated thing. And you can rephrase this argument basically to say that, you know, from the point of view of this picture, 1 over n is not a parameter, as I emphasized before. And so it doesn't make sense that there could be another solution to the equations of motion that differs from this one by an amount 1 over n, by a change in the gravitational field that's like 1 over n, because this system just doesn't know about n. And so what happens in this picture when the tachyon condenses must be something very, very complicated, where it goes through some horrible intermediate stage and then eventually ends up at C mod Zn minus 2, which has a dual description, which happens to look just like this. But in between, it's nothing that you can understand just in gravity. In between, it's something very complicated and stringy. OK, so I hope I've convinced you that we wish we knew more about closed string tachyons. But that there are several still not completely explored routes for trying to understand this system. Thanks very much.
Questions, comments?
I'm a little confused about how this could have not worked in a way. This last thing. So just in conformal field theory, is it true that the C mod Zn minus 2 conformal field theory can be thought of as C mod Zn with a small addition of the operator corresponding to the twice winding tachyon? Is it true in the Zamolodchikov sense, you know, the way that one minimal model up in that series?
I think probably the answer is no, it's not true.
It's not
true. I think probably the answer is it's very far away. If you look at, okay, there are two incomplete answers to that. I mean, it's an excellent question, and I don't know what the answer is, but if you look at the gauge linear signal model, then the operator that you add, which becomes, when you flow to the IR, this tachyon vertex operator, really kind of takes over the entire conformal field theory in some sense. It's not a small perturbation on the conformal field theory. The other thing is that if in these you have enough supersymmetry on the world sheet that you can use a Witten index argument, and I think that the Witten index changes, and that would imply that the only way that can happen is if you've moved an infinite distance, I think in the Zamolodchikov sense. That argument is not completely tight because it's a non-compact target space, so it may be more of a heuristic argument. But it suggests that you've moved an infinite distance. It's a confusing issue.
Yeah, so for the minimal models, the Zamolodchikovs and then Ashok and various other people were able to make rather tight tests of the statement. It might be worth running one of these.
But you know,
you think it's obvious that it's not.
Right, but Ashok's thing was in the n equals 0 and n equals 1 minimal models. Now, there's a paper by Svetich and Kutasov where they tried to do the same thing for n equals 2. And there the Witten argument basically proves that it doesn't happen, that it's not true.
Any other question? Well, if not, let's thank Matthew again. So please do not forget to pick up your participation certificate with Alexandra, okay?